So we're going to kick off. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. I realize we're still miking some people up. Oh, I did. Hopefully they're hearing us. So thank you all for being here. Really appreciate it. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Ron Quaranta, and it's my privilege to serve as chairman of the board of the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance. For those of you who do know me, I promise I won't be up here very long. Thank you all for joining us this evening. My personal thanks to our hosts from Seward and Kissel, who are always very, very helpful, always very generous with their time and space. I also wanted to thank our moderator, Dr. Sean Stein-Smith, who will be here and who I've been stalking on LinkedIn for far too long, so it's good to finally be collaborating with him. Let me also thank our panelists from our corporate members at Withum Smith & Brown, Libra Tech, and Clifton Larson Allen, as well as our friends from Boomer Consulting. The Wall Street Blockchain Alliance is a nonprofit trade association based here in New York. We have footprint in London. We have footprint in Sydney. And thanks to a lot of our colleagues, we will soon have a satellite office in Shanghai, which will be very, very interesting. And our mission is to guide and promote comprehensive adoption of blockchain technology and crypto assets across global markets. Over the past 18 months, this mission has been no more apparent than in our work with our strategic partners at AICPA and CPA.com. As well as with our corporate members from across the growing number of accounting professionals and accounting firms that we have, some again who we're very privileged to have as part of this evening's panel. Indeed, as with so many industries that are impacted by blockchain technology, what we're witnessing is the evolution of the accounting profession. Eric, you and I have spoken about this so many times. An evolution in not just accounting, but as other professions try to understand how they do what they do. And ultimately an evolution on what our roles are going to be in that future. This evening's discussions will focus on some of the more in-depth issues that the accounting profession has faced and continues to face in the wake of these current innovations such as blockchain. Issues such as taxation of crypto assets, the evolving role of the audit, the challenges of attestation in a blockchain and smart contract world, and much more. And as you'll see, our panelists are already recognized thought leaders at the intersection of tax, accounting, blockchain, crypto assets, law, and more. This evening's meeting will be the first of many, and our hope is that you'll be able to walk away with the knowledge and actionable intelligence that we always focus on, intelligence that helps you prepare yourselves and your firms for a future in a blockchain and a crypto asset world. So I promised my team I wouldn't be up here very long. So with that, thank you for being with us this evening. Thank you to all our colleagues who dialed in. I made the mistake of saying we'll be live streaming this, and a whole bunch of people said we're not coming, even though we had cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. And with that, I will step over and offer our host, Mr. John Bros.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for coming. I'm John Brosi. I am a partner in the tax group at Seward & Kissel. I am a member of our blockchain and crypto practice. I just want to tell you a little bit about that here. Although first, I'll give a shout out to my partner, Anthony Tusakina, who was supposed to do this introduction. He's the leader of our blockchain practice, but he had a family emergency to attend to tonight, so he could not make it, asked me to step in. So our crypto practice is an interdisciplinary practice. We're a global, a financial services firm. When I say global, we do things all around the world. We now have global offices, but, we service clients all around the world in the financial space. And so for us, it made sense to bring across various disciplines into blockchain. We have corporate finance and securities, commodities, broker-dealer, tax, UCC, bankruptcy, all those practices that we have, can be brought to bear in the crypto space. We historically have, one of the largest investment fund practices in the country. And, many of our clients in that space have been interested in crypto. We represent crypto funds. Anthony, who works in our DC office, has more, I guess, traditional crypto clients who are actually doing ICOs or setting up exchanges and things like that. So we really hit, I think, everything in that space. We like to position ourselves as thought leaders. We speak a lot. We publish articles. Brett Kotler, my tax colleague, and I, Brett's going to be on the panel tonight, you know, wrote a pretty, what I think is still probably the most comprehensive article on crypto taxation that's out there. We self-published it, so we didn't publish it in any publication. So it's floating out there somewhere. You could get it from Brett afterward. So that's what we're about. Soren Kissel is delighted to host this tonight. And before I introduce the keynote speaker, I do have to apologize, but since I was a sub for the introduction, I also have a family commitment. I'm going to have to take off after this, but Brett will be holding down the fort for Soren Kissel. So with that, I would like to introduce our keynote speaker, the CEO of CPA.com. And I'm going to try to get this name right. It's Eric Asgeirsson. Is that right?
Yeah.
Close enough, right?
Oh,
okay, very good. All right, with that, Eric,
take it away.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to be. I don't know if I'm the keynote speaker. I've got, like Ron, I always keynote. I have a few just opening remarks, and then I'm very much looking forward to tonight's panel discussion. I know I'm gonna learn a lot. But yeah, my name is Eric Asgeirsson. I'm the CEO of CPA.com. The business and technology arm for the AICPA. And I, in some ways, co-lead a lot of our blockchain activities with Sue Coffey, who will be joining us shortly. Amy Beers is here. She works on Sue Coffey's team. Sue Coffey leads the public practice section for the AICPA. The AICPA is the largest accounting body in the world, largest accounting body here in the United States with over 400,000 members, does advocacy, thought leadership, helps with, educational activities with the profession. And they also set private company auditing standards. So blockchain is extremely important to what's happening with the accounting profession. Technology is changing the practice of accounting. And it was a couple of years ago that we realized that we really need to take a harder look at, what blockchain meant to the audit, to the tax area, to accounting services. And that's when we connected with Ron Quanta and the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance. And this is a very, very important partnership for us. What we've been trying to do with Ron and the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance is really frame the discussion. I remember a few years back, I'd be sitting at events and some people would say, I'm glad I'm retiring in 5 years because it's the end of the audit because of blockchain. And actually, that couldn't be further from the truth. And we could get into that. But Ron and the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance has played an important role with the AICPA and CPA.com in helping frame the discussion. This is really an opportunity. It's a great opportunity for businesses. It's a great opportunity for the profession, for the CPA profession to lead. And I'm just going to briefly note some of the activities that we have underway. We've got, five big streams. One is thought leadership. I would say the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance is a big part of that. Guidance. And I'm going to talk about two work streams, working groups that we have underway to provide more guidance to firms in the marketplace. Advocacy here with the marketplace and events like this. Advocacy at times, if it's a meeting with the SEC or the IRS or government officials on blockchain and what's going on with the profession. Tools and resources, putting out a lot of, we've got a blockchain certificate. We're trying to educate the 40,000 plus firms in the United States around blockchain. That's important. So tools and resources related to that. And then learning and development resources. So just real briefly, and these are some new activities, things that have just recently really got underway in a material fashion around the member guidance area. We've got two working groups. One of the working groups is being led by our Assurance Services Executive Committee. We got a lot of acronyms like everybody else. We call it the ASAC, Trust Information Integrity Task Force. That's the official name. And what they're looking at is how SOC's a very important assurance standard, how that that's based on the trust principles, how could that be leveraged for things like smart contracts? There's a lot of potential there, and the team with a lot of subject matter experts are looking at how we potentially could leverage SOC 1 and SOC 2 engagements related to smart contracts. That's a very, very exciting development that started in August of 2018. And then we've got a group looking at the crypto assets, both from an accounting and auditing standpoint. And this is, it was kicked off by the chairs of ASAC, ASB, that's the Auditing Standards Board, and the FinRec committee. So these are great technical committees with some of the leaders in the profession thinking hard about how to leverage existing standards or produce new guidance to help related to blockchain. So, Ron, I know that's of interest, and so things are underway, and it's just great to be here. After this event, you ask questions to me about some of our activities. Amy Beers, or as I said, Sue Coffey, will be getting here shortly, so we can hit her with some questions maybe in the open portion of it. So with that, Ron, I think next up is the panel. So I'll let the panel do their introductions, and thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so to echo the earlier comments from Ron and from Eric, obviously the whole topic of obviously blockchain and the entire crypto asset area is possibly the hottest topic that has been in the accounting field for the last 20 years. And so I'm very amped to be up here serving as the moderator for this panel. If I could advance the slide here so I could put the names of our panelists up here, that would help out quite a bit. Okay, perfect. So in the interim, and just to get the ball rolling, I'm going to actually hand it over to our panelists to do some self introduction, just to make sure that I don't forget anything. Brett, you want to start us off?
Thank you. My name is Brett Kotler. I'm a tax attorney here at Seward & Kissel. And as John Brosi mentioned, we took a dive into the crypto space, and here we are tonight.
Awesome. Good evening, everyone. I'm Amanda Wilkie. I am a consultant with Boomer Consulting. I've been in public accounting for about 14 years, working in multiple firms. I'm very excited about blockchain. Got excited about it probably 4 or 5 years ago, and very happy to see all of the evolution that we've seen in this space over the last couple of years in the profession.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Watson. I'm principal with Clifton Larson Allen, but you can call us CLA. A lot easier than Clifton Larson Allen. We're, I think, the eighth largest firm in the country, and we focus on all different types of industries, professional services, CPA, wealth advisory, consulting, et cetera, and outsourcing. I am managing principal of the Philadelphia office, but really sort of an auditor by trade, and for the last 12 months or so have been focusing on our future innovations team, serving on that team, and was tasked with really understanding blockchain and crypto and what are some of those impacts and how are we addressing those and working with those for our clients.
Awesome. My name is Jeremy Drain. I'm the Chief Commercial Officer for Libra. Libra is one of, if not the largest, crypto-centric middle and back office software provider in the world. What we do is pretty simple. We take distributed and decentralized data. We normalize that data, we process it, and then we use it to create financial statements, management reports, auditing reports, regulatory reports. Our customers are funds and fund administrators, OTC and prop trading firms, and crypto exchanges.
Okay, so obviously all four panelists that are here tonight are obviously very well respected members of the corporate accounting, corporate finance, corporate IT community. So I'm very amped to be part of this whole conversation. And so probably the first topic that I would like to cover, if I'm having any conversation on accounting or finance and the whole blockchain space, is to you cover some of the evolutions and advances happening in the crypto asset aspect of it. And probably the most timely topic or part of that conversation is basically how to classify tokens, individual cryptocurrencies, and the whole conversation that is happening in that airdrop area. And obviously the whole airdrop conversation is a new conversation. All of that is still very fast moving, but it's basically being almost thought of as the alternative, right, to the ICO process. So, and I don't know if anybody has any preference to actually start, but I'm very interested in sort of thoughts or hands-on applications in this area that any of you have handled. So Brett, you want to start us off with that? Just make it easier?
Sure.
Okay.
So one of the issues with airdrops from a tax perspective is valuation. So if you're a token holder and you receive a distribution or an airdrop of other tokens in your crypto wallet, is that income to you? Is it not? What's your basis in that property? If you sold it a week later, do you get a tax holding period? So those are all open questions. My personal view on this, even though there is disagreement in the field, is that yes, this would be income to the holder, and that's certainly the more conservative approach to take as income that's taken into account by the holder. If you're a U.S. person, that's your starting basis in the property, and you know, when you later sell it, you'll have gain or loss equal to the difference between what you receive and what that basis was. But I do understand that there are other opinions out there treating, maybe they treat it as zero basis property because maybe when the airdrop was announced or effectuated, maybe you take a view that the tokens didn't have any value at that time. And I know some people analogize hard forks and airdrops to traditional corporate actions such as stock splits and dividends. But from a tax perspective, those rules are, you know, very much so limited to traditional C corporations. And if you're dealing with a decentralized network, you're not dealing with a C corp, you're not dealing with stocks. So I don't think those rules apply. And I do know there is some proposed legislation out actually earlier this week that does would say that hard forks would not be result in the recognition of income, but that's merely a proposal at this point.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If I if my firm knew I was talking about tax, they'd probably come running over here and try to handcuff me or something, or mute me. But you know, I think to Brett's point, you know, where we've been in a position of trying to apply what guidance we have to different transactions and things in the crypto space. As far as, you know, I think we all know, is what the IRS put out in 2014 was, you know, they claimed it as property. So we've been sort of, you know, boxed in, if you will, to a certain sort of set of criteria that we're able to follow. And I think as it relates to the airdrops or hard forks, it's the same situation as you outlined, Brett. It's basically what's the value as of that X date. And, you know, for us, I think some of the areas that we've seen an evolution around is as these things are being exchanged on exchange, is there an opportunity to use like a 1031 exchange or something like that and shift some of that gain in different basis around it. So, you know, I think, you know, as we stand, we're closely monitoring to see what the, you know, the Senate obviously is pushing a lot of pressure on the IRS to provide that guidance. And there are some proposed laws out there, and we're monitoring that closely. But we are probably, I would say as a firm, we're probably taking the most conservative position with our clients. And I know after the SEC sent all those wonderful subpoenas out to Coinbase and all that fun stuff, we had a lot of clients, really individual tax return clients that approached us and said, you know, we're going to go do an amendment for the last couple of years and try to get ahead of this. So there's certainly a lot of that that's evolved over the last, you know, two and a half years.
I guess what I comment on this topic is, you know, those are very important issues, and we're always very interested in the cost basis of asset. But the issue is, at least as it relates to airdrops, is no one can find them. They show up on an exchange. They're not considered a trade or a transfer, so you can't pull them back through the API. So all of a sudden, you have a balance that shows that you have some asset that you didn't even know you had. Most people that get airdrops don't even know they're getting them. And so I think the issue is there's obviously a there's obviously an issue regarding the proper way to value and establish cost basis in an asset, but there's an assumption there that you actually know that you have an asset and that you actually can go get the data so that you can actually do your reporting. And what we find is that most people, whether they're a hedge fund, whether they're an individualist, they don't even know that this data exists and they have no way to get it. And so those are some of the issues that we see that are more tactical in nature in terms of being able to deal with these issues, because most people don't even know they have them.
No, and I think all of those are excellent points. And also sort of brings up the other question, right? Is that part A, right? There are basically two options, right, to actually get airdrop tokens. It can either be through a hard fork or a bounty airdrop where there is no actually action taken on the part of the individuals who are being airdropped, or there is that option B where the institution or the individual, you could have to do something, right? To either pay some compensation or to be a part of a group or a list. So all of that adds that extra sort of complication into this whole space. And then also to just sort of add some more fun into the mix, really the only firm guidance out there in this area is that IRS memo from 2014. So obviously everything has changed quite a bit, right? Right. I mean, from 2014 through to 2018. So I'd be curious to see, and probably Brett and I would probably Brett and Jeremy, probably the two folks who would probably could have this happen. Have the two of you or your firms or clients of yours been a part of airdrops that have caused some of these actual questions to happen to them?
Well, yeah, I mean,
high level stuff only, right? Nothing confidential.
Yeah, obviously customer information is confidential. But what I would broadly say is the issue is that you execute a P&L and you think that you've gathered all your transactions. And then all of a sudden it's the end of a period. And, you know, you've got a bunch of transactions that could be meaningful. I mean, if you have a zero cost basis and then all of a sudden the thing is trading at a significant number, all of a sudden you have something that could be material. And, you know, what are you supposed to do? Well, you've got to go back and you've got to change your P&L. And for a lot of the trader types that we deal with, you know, this is obviously not something that, you know, their auditors or, you know, their internal accountants are excited about, which is the changing of the results of the daily P&L exercise. So mostly what we see it is in terms of just people don't know they have it. They assume that they have all of their trades and transfers. They assume that they have data accuracy and completeness, which they don't. They establish a report. They file that report internally, and it turns out that they do not have data accuracy or completeness, and they have to then go through a process to amend those P&Ls, which creates maybe not a very complicated exercise, but certainly heartburn for the finance function.
Even a little scary, you know, because you go through all of those processes, like you said, expecting the data to be correct, expecting the data to be there, but you don't even know what you're looking for. You don't even know to go out and look for it. So, you know, what else could be out there? What's the next thing that could be a surprise?
Almost one of those known unknowns and the unknowns,
yeah. Right?
Right. And adding all that extra uncertainty into the conversation. And I think that sort of dovetails into a topic that really is a hot topic at pretty much every conference that I go to or each article that I read, is to actually how to actually get that data off of the platforms, off of the blockchain itself, and then actually pipe it through into a ERP or into a software package to actually turn it into a accurate P&L that is actually accurate and sort of up to date. And probably one of the most current sort of conversations in this whole space, right? Because the whole field is obviously quite interested in the impact that blockchain is going to have on the audit function. And probably the sort of rising use or rising interest in the whole field of a smart contract is actually sort of making this a more palpable conversation in the field. So I was wondering, and maybe James, we could start with you, your sort of thoughts on that possible impact of as actually more data is put on the blockchain and sort of those second and those third level applications are then built out on the blockchain. What is that impact actually going to be on auditing, on tax reporting, or even just trying to do some P&Ls and some ad hoc?
Yeah, and that was pretty broad. So I'll try to maybe narrow in on the smart contract piece. And, you know, I think what's important is we sort of throw the smart contract term around quite a bit, but you have to really look at the underlying components of where that smart contract exists, whether it's a true, you know, just pure ECR20, you know, Ethereum, you know, totally decentralized, permissionless set, or if it's some part of a private blockchain or some, you know, smart contract that's sort of held within a system that's permission based. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if we get back to the evolution question, if I'm going to think of examples, everybody knows that Walmart just announced, you know, we're going to basically focus on our supply chain around lettuce, and we're going to be able to get to the point where all of our vendors and everybody along that supply chain are on what I would perceive to be our blockchain, right? Which is that, to me, that's kind of the crux of it. You know, what is that smart contract? Where does it sit? And who owns that technology? But to give you an example, we have a client that's actually a big vendor for Walmart and is very concerned about what's that impact. So, you know, it's if we're not necessarily at a point where we're auditing the transactions on that smart contract, obviously I would probably reach out to Jeremy and get some of his perspective on that. But, you know, from an audit perspective of our client, we really need to understand the entire transaction set, if you will, that are impacting that P&L. What I think is important, and I think it was Ricky and I said, or maybe Ron in one of the openings, is, you know, this idea that auditing is dead, right? And you know, I think if you start looking at blockchain technology, you might go down that path and think, oh, wow, it's a distributed ledger, right? And once we hear ledger, we think accounting is all over that. But at the end of the day, nobody's really putting all of their transactions in their entire ledger financial reporting system on a blockchain, and I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. What's going to happen is there's going to be different types of transactions, and what you're going to need to do is have auditors, if you will, if you want to go under that context, be able to navigate to the underlying transaction and really understand where that database sits. And, you know, I think for the record, you're talking about, you know, the SOCs, the SOC reports, you know, we have a group that does that. Again, if I talk about it, they would come try to mute me. But, you know, what I think is relevant there is really the skill set that's going to be necessary. And I'm sure not everybody in here is auditors in the room, but from an audit perspective, just the skill sets of really understanding the underlying logic and being able to sort of map through that logic to get to the transaction that really affects the company. So I don't know if that was a real specific answer, but you know, I think from a smart contract perspective.
No, and so I think you brought up a excellent point there, right? That auditors and anybody working in accounting or in finance, those individuals aren't going to have to know all of the operations and nuts and bolts of how a blockchain works or how any of those applications running on that blockchain works, but it is going to be more of an opportunity. And I know that Amanda and I were having this conversation earlier, is that as this becomes more and more sort of mainstream, what is that role of an auditor going to turn into, or almost anybody working in accounting going to actually turn into?
I don't want to tell anyone what.
Put me on the spot.
Yeah, I don't want to tell anyone what they're going to be doing in the next few years. But yeah, it is definitely going to evolve. I mean, I'm a technology person, so I love to understand how these things are working. That's what really piqued my interest in blockchain a few years ago. But I'm reminded on a almost a regular basis from some of my colleagues that, you know, CPAs, you know, not all of them care about those inner workings. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to know how the watch works to be able to tell time. And I think that's absolutely true. But I think also understanding how it works at a little deeper level helps us trust the technology a bit more. And we're then able to take that trust in the technology and pass that along to our clients. And that's what the clients are really wanting. They're confused. Like you said, you know, Walmart, you know, we've been talking to firms, and we've told them if Walmart comes in and tells your clients in the next 3 to 5 years that they're going to have to opt in and use these systems, it's not only your opportunity to advise them, but it's your responsibility to advise them and understand the technology enough to trust what's coming out of those systems. And especially smaller firms that we've talked to, you know, they've thought of multiple clients that are suppliers to Walmart. So they have a lot of work to do in this area. Again, I know I'm skirting around your actual question of what's the auditor really going to look like.
It's fun.
I think it is a bit more of a balance, and you're mm-hmm. going to have to understand the technology as well as the accounting. It's also an opportunity for some of us technology-minded folks to partner with the CPAs and leverage each other's strengths in those areas.
Excellent point there, Amanda. And that really, this whole sort of change that is happening, and no one's going to know ultimately how it's going to end up, right? But it is going to give a opportunity for individuals who are more inclined to embrace technology, other opportunities to actually be more, I think, forward-thinking overall. And Brett, I do want to ask you sort of your thoughts on this whole space of a smart contract, right? Because it's not actually an actual contract. Right. And so how is it different, and sort of how is it viewed from your point of view?
So actually, I have a friend in the space who says a smart contract is neither smart nor a contract. And that is at the moment accurate. But I also view smart contracts as a great opportunity where from a legal perspective, but also accounting audit, to really partner with the technology folks. Because at a certain point, a smart contract is computer code, and you want to make sure that the code operates as intended, and I don't know how to tell you that, but there are people smarter than me who can. What if the code fails or does something unexpected? How do you correct that, or do you correct that? And a lot of people say, well, if you wrote bad code, then you're stuck with a bad result. But what if you're dealing with a very sophisticated financial transaction where maybe that's not the right answer? How do you deal with this? Do you have legal recourse? Do you have, you know, for smaller transactions, maybe you just go to the counterparty and say, hey, you know, we screwed up, can we correct this? But if you have a huge transaction, you might not be able to do that. So from that perspective, I think it's a very interesting opportunity to create partnerships with other folks in the industry and work together to come find these answers, really. But right now, those are open questions. In terms of smart contracts generally, it's, you know, we're still at the beginning. We see a couple applications of them so far. My experience with one particular smart contract that we really struggled with, and I'll share that fact pattern briefly, is just, you know, it really forced us to think about a lot of basic issues in a manner that we don't really think about it. And it was essentially, we had an ICO company that was selling its tokens through a smart contract. The token holders would come in, and the smart contract would maintain a liquidity pool. So if the token holders wanted to get out of the token and redeem back out to Ethereum or Bitcoin or however they came in, the smart contract would govern it, and it had an algorithm to allocate a portion of that liquidity pool to maintain to the redeeming out token holder, and that would maintain the price and lower volatility. That's at least the goal of it. I'm not sure if it launched yet. So the questions for us was, okay, is that income to the company? And for various reasons, we're getting comfortable that it's not income to the company. And part of that's driven actually by the bankruptcy analysis, because one of the questions is, okay, are the assets that are subject to the smart contract, whose property are those? If I'm the token issuer, can my creditors go after that pool? If I'm a token holder, can my creditors go after that pool? And, you know, a little bit of guesswork, a little bit of research, a little bit of intuition, and, you know, we drilled down on the analysis, but it's, you know, it raised a lot of these fundamental issues, and it was a very interesting project to work on.
And actually, really sort of building on that, Brett, is that all of that really does point to two facts, right? One is that all of this stuff is still new, right? Mm-hmm. There is no hard guidance out there yet from anybody on any of these issues that have to do with ICOs and the income that's associated with them, and then all of the other applications that are being built out. And then sort of echoing back to a earlier point, is that it's so important to understand what actually is happening in this process, right? Whether it's an ICO process, it's an airdrop process, or just any sort of basic blockchain application. It's important to understand at the very least a basic level so that as an accountant, as an auditor, as a IT expert, right, you're able to actually offer those advisory services going forward. And so, yes,
John,
sure, Amanda.
Just one comment about what Brett said.
Absolutely.
You know, how do you know that the smart contract, the code, is doing what it's supposed to do? And to your point, Sean, all of this is all so very new. You know, it's like in the 90s, if you could put Java on your resume, you got job offer after job offer. You put blockchain on your resume. No one has more than 10 years experience in blockchain. No, you know, and a lot of people don't have more than a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So it's all of these technologies are very new and they're being applied in new ways. So it would be very, very easy to make some of those mistakes, which is, again, kind of where the auditing comes in. But also when you're looking at auditing the smart contract, if you look right now, most of those audits are making sure that the code is doing what the code is supposed to do. But not necessarily does the smart contract adhere to, you know, regulation or adhere to business logic. And that, again, with that partnership between the technology and the you know, law experts and the accounting experts, it's a team effort to make mm-hmm. sure that these things are actually doing what they're supposed to do from all aspects.
Absolutely. And yeah, also to,
sorry,
to
yep, sorry. Anybody that was had blockchain on their resume 10 years ago, they're driving around in Lambos now, so
right.
they're not looking
anymore.
For jobs.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a great comment, not to add, it doesn't need to be added to, but I think, you know, just some insight into what we're grappling with a little bit is it is going to take a multidisciplinary team on both sides, whether it's the CPA side of the world or the corporate side of the world, to be able to either manage the assertions around all these contracts and different types of utilization of the technology, but certainly from either an audit or a tax perspective, you know, for the CPAs, we need to really engage people that are not traditional accountants to do that work.
I was thinking that the regular conventional auditor would not be able to function. They would have to, as you said, team up with experts in the technology field.
Yeah. Yeah. And to give you an example of what our firm's doing, we're lucky, we're large enough that we've got a group that does IT auditing and hacking and vulnerability assessments and all that. So we've got what my partner that leads that affectionately calls propeller heads that we can bring in. And we've been bringing in over the years from an audit perspective, because obviously we have to have that risk-based approach. We need to understand the IT controls around it. And I think the way we're looking at this is, what are the different controls around, you know, utilizing this technology or engaging in, whether it's a smart contract or whatever the case may be, so that the, you know, the assertions and, you know, Jeremy, you mentioned that accuracy and existence, like those assertions are being maintained by management. And again, that comes back to, you know, we have to bring the technical expertise along with us, but I think accounting departments and finance departments really have to have somebody engaged in that process as well on their end. I think we have another question too.
Following up on that,
we'd like tangents.
Yeah. You never quite get there.
That's
what. It's been superseded, but I'm thinking of the old SAS 70 internal control audits and the challenges that, you know, you face. The client space now, maybe you can comment more broadly. I mean, just yesterday, Fidelity announced, you know, the creation of this digital, you know, subsidiary, digital asset subsidiary to handle custody, for example, and trading, be a trading platform for hedge funds, pension plans, et cetera. And I'm sure pension plans would be looking for the, what is the modern day, the numbers changed, I forget. The modern day equivalent of a SAS 70 before they'll do business with, I presume, before they'll do business in crypto with Fidelity and be sure they've got secure controls. I don't know, two, too much to add to that, but I'm interested in your reaction to that. I mean, is do you have insight into whether certain firms already have integrated crypto into their controls to the point where they're ready to step up and could, you know, have a favorable audit based on those standards?
You want me to leave? So
I have a comment.
Well,
though.
Okay. Well, I'll just make sure I got my history right. I think it was SAS 70, SSA 16 to SOC reports now, right? Is that
right?
I didn't miss one, right? So I think Rick mentioned that CPA.com is really looking at how could we implement that for that approach. And our firm does a ton of SOC audits, but we have individuals that are focused solely on that. So if you look at service organization controls and you're basically talking about an entity that's being formed to provide a service, what are the controls around that that are going to be, you know, somebody needs to come in and take a look at and verify and give an opinion on? I think that's definitely being contemplated, and I think that's going to happen. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. The comment I was going to make was I think back to the AICPA blockchain symposium in May, and you know, firms got together, thought leaders got together, some of the software vendors got together, and we started having some of these conversations, and the firms in the room, you know, they kind of to your point, you know, they said they were kind of pulling pieces from SOC 1, SOC 2, SOC for cyber. So they realized that, you know, there wasn't necessarily any one, you know, any one tool quite yet that they could use. So I was very happy to hear that that they have a working group that's working on that. And you have the microphone, so.
I could let Sue or Amy Coffey, who's here now, or Amy Beers comment on this, but I was actually with Chris Haldeman earlier today, and he's somebody who's had a big role with the SOC reports. So yes, you know, it was SAS 70, SA 16, you know, SOC 1 and SOC 2 reports, and their look, which is very exciting. Look, the working group's looking at, you know, how could the SOC standards support smart contracts. So. You know, maybe Amy and Sue could expand more on that, but that would be, that's something we talked about at this blockchain symposium with some of the leaders in the accounting profession a few months ago, and the AICPA has kicked off this important working group under ASAC to kind of really dig deeper and see, you know, again, what I said in the opening was looking at existing standards, what could be leveraged, and if there's new guidance. You know, what, you know, how should we go about that?
Can I make a couple comments? Like, this is a topic I could talk about all day. Okay. So let's separate, what we're talking about. So we have system audits of smart contracts. That's a cool topic, and we can talk about that. And then we have the use of SOC in terms of a framework for the supporting of crypto reporting. Similar, but not the same. Okay. So as it relates to the first, so Libra has done a significant amount of work with Rutgers University, and we actually have essentially taken a series of smart contracts and run them through the current SOC certifications, and we have another gentleman, Rod Brennan, who's not here today. But essentially, we have published and have a whole bunch of detail that basically say a majority of the current the majority of the work to get that certification is irrelevant as it relates to smart contracts from a number of different dimensions. And so that's something that we have spent a significant amount of time with. And the reason being is because smart contracts are often endpoints that we have to go get data from, right? Smart contracts have a very limited amount of data that they actually can provide you. And if we are dealing with a hedge fund that has assets across 55 different smart contracts, all of which Each one of those smart contracts has a unique API that we would have to pull data from. The question is how do we have assurance at the end of the day that that smart contract is operating in a manner that we can actually rely on that data, because we're going to organize that data, we're going to aggregate it, and then we're going to actually do financial reporting from that. So we have a perspective there, which is the current SOX standards have to be reworked. I think Amanda's point is very well, and Amanda and I have actually talked on this quite a bit over the years, which is you got to beg, borrow, and steal from a bunch of different things to actually make it accurate. So that's sort of like number one point. Number two point is Libra is in the process of getting a SOC 1 Type 2 on our infrastructure, because we provide the NAV data that's used to create for a hedge fund to strike NAV. Fund administrators won't actually use a SaaS provider that doesn't have a SOC 1 Type 2 because they're relying on our data, because it's financial data that's used for reporting purposes. So I'm happy to say that we are incredibly far down that path. And I would think in the world of crypto blockchain that Libra will be the very first SOC 1 Type 2 accredited software company in the world, bar none. Stay tuned for our press release in that area.
I think that was just your...
Libra, we are a middle and back office software provider. So we essentially aggregate distributed and decentralized data. We normalize it, standardize it. We then reconcile it back to source. And then we process it and produce reporting. I think generally the issue that we view is that most people spend a majority of the time thinking about how do we audit source, like how do we audit a smart contract or an exchange. But the reality is all of the financial reporting actually happens further upstream and at the aggregation point. And so our expertise is at the aggregation points, pulling data from source.
And what I would say is that probably sort of based on our conversation and also input from the audience here, is that two extra sort of core points could be added into this conversation, right? One is that as these institutions get more and more interested in various crypto assets and are actually putting money into it, whether it's at a Fidelity, whether it's at the Yale or Harvard endowments, as these big money groups and funds are more and more interested, that all that could possibly help push the conversation forward to help improve some of the assurance and auditing standards also evolving in this area. And that honestly, point number two is that the individuals working in finance, accounting, IT, and law in the future are going to have, I would say, almost a more broad-based mindset, right, as to how to actually do their jobs and how to interact with other functional experts. I'd say that those are two also sort of key takeaway points here. And sort of our earlier conversation sort of did sort of blend over into really the audit applications and sort of how individuals and firms are going to be able to audit this information on the blockchain. And I do think, and I don't want to summarize too much, but I would almost say that right now it's a work in progress. There are some firms out there who are doing some excellent work in this space, but it's still a evolving issue. And I just don't know if anybody had any final thoughts on this topic.
I guess what I would say is, auditing is going to be a combination of computer science and mathematics. And it is, I think, a combination of those specific skill sets that are going to be required. And generally speaking, the technology moves so much faster than our ability to educate ourselves with a way to actually do something. So just a recognition that, we're always going to be behind the curve. It's going to be fun times. I think for people that are, people in big firms, I think, there's some challenges there. I think the work that we see, a majority of the smaller firms actually are doing some really exciting work. So I came from the Big Four, and you know, we see what they're doing, and broadly speaking, is, you know, they're waiting for regulation to catch up, and that makes a lot of sense because of, you know, their role in the ecosystem. But you know, customers need solutions today, and what we see is a lot of the smaller firms actually doing the work, and whether it's auditing hedge funds that hold crypto, or you know, trying to do custody for exchanges that are, I mean, a lot of that stuff is happening. And so it's been really interesting for me coming from the Big Four, going down and working in a little startup, that a majority of the people that we end up interacting with are the small to mid-sized firms, because they're willing to take on the risk of having not quite all of the regulatory answers and being able to, you know, walk around in a dark room and try to figure it out. And so, you know, props to the small to mid-sized firms.
Yeah, I think you have to balance risk and agility sometimes in this environment. And, you know, I would agree that, you know, I think depending on the size of the firm or size of the clients that they're working at, there's probably different factors within both of those streams. Just lost my train of thought. I was geeking out still on the last thing you said, Jeremy. So I'm still lost my train of thought around what I was going to say, but I'll pass that on then.
I'll say, to your point, Jeremy, you know, some of the smaller firms are doing some really, really cool things, but I don't think I've ever seen a technology that brings competitors together like blockchain. I mean, the accounting industry has always been very closely knit. So you may be a colleague one day and a competitor the next day, but you know, you go to the bar and you're all still friends. But if you look at like the banking system and how these global banks that would be competitors came together and are coming together over this technology, I mean, that shows me how, you know, how impactful it really is and the attention that that it's really getting.
I remember my train of thought. That's sorry to interrupt, but it's not just blockchain, right? I mean, we're obviously talking about blockchain today, but we're also sort of overlaying this audit aspect and other issues that we have to deal with. But it's, you know, robotic process automation, it's AI, it's all these things are converging at once. And what's, on one hand, it's a little bit scary for, you know, people like me that came up a little bit while ago. But on the other hand, it's really, really exciting and impactful for some of our younger people coming into the profession. I'll just share with you a quick story that really drove my interest in blockchain, quite frankly, again, 12, 15 months ago. We had a office party, and I'm the managing principal of our Philadelphia office, so I have to mingle and all that kind of stuff. And I was trying to figure out where all our younger staff were that recently joined, so I can go make sure they're, you know, drinking appropriately and not putting our firm at risk. And so anyway, I went down and we were in a country club. There was a bowling alley downstairs and they were all gathered around there. And I literally walked in on them all talking about Bitcoin and blockchain and all these other crypto assets. And, you know, they're just talking around, did you know about this? Do you know about that? And the excitement around it for me was just, it was really compelling. So for me, if I back up, I think about, you know, for our firm, if you bring somebody right out of college, they just learned all these cool things, they come into our firm, they come to do the audit, and we tell them, you know, go audit cash and do the same thing we did last year, that's not a good place to be, right? We want to be where it's, all right, everything's kind of done, we have all this technology in place, let's really move to the true, you know, risk analysis, and what is this information telling us, and how does it help our clients? So I, for me, I just think it's a, you know, we have to broaden that spectrum a little bit outside of, you know, just blockchain in general. It's a lot of things that are impacting our industry on both sides of the fence, and it's an exciting time to be a part of it.
Sure, absolutely.
I know you're talking about auditing and risk analysis and so forth, and what auditors should be doing and what they need to be thinking about. But what are some of the industries that are using blockchain to create efficiencies within their company, and why is it of concern to auditors now? If it will only be a concern if there are a number of different industries that are actually using the application or are planning to use the application. So could you speak a little bit about the industries? I know banking definitely is obvious, but what are some of the other industries that are poised to use blockchain in a powerful way in the future?
So our firm is completely outlined by industry. I'm actually a healthcare person. That's been my practice area, but we have healthcare, we have agribusiness, we have manufacturing, distribution, construction, real estate, financial institutions. they're all the leaders within those industries, I interact with them in my role on our future innovation team. They are all trying to figure out and work with their clients, figure out what the issues are around blockchain. The ones I've seen a lot of impact around, quite frankly, obviously financial institutions, but, our financial institutions are really looking at more from a clearinghouse perspective, what's that part of our business that's going to be affected? I think they understand it, but they don't necessarily, I don't know that they have a plan in place for it. But locally, sort of outside of the global settlement process, I don't know that they're doing a lot here locally. At least our clients, we're not a big force, so we're not really outside of the country. Well, the one I've seen a lot of traction around is our agribusiness group. I actually went and we did a seminar with a large client base with that industry, and I went out and sort of did the blockchain 101. And I honestly, it was probably my bias and it was incorrect. I thought I was going to go in there and talk to a bunch of farmers that didn't know anything about blockchain. And I went and I got more interactions and questions. They're all over it. I'm trying to remember the big one. Dreyfus is a really large soybean company, a farming company, a huge conglomerate that just put something on one of their vendor supply chains on a blockchain and was transacting with China and all this other stuff. And they're aware of this. They know it's impacting their business. Our M&D group, manufacturing distribution group, they're laser focused on, how can they utilize this again from their position within the supply chain. And then within healthcare, I don't know if you've ever audited a health system before, but the amount of different payment streams and things that are flying in and out, I'm under the impression that if CMS could just figure out how to, kind of put a blockchain together around all their remittance, just within the different contracts relative to their payer systems, we'd be a much better cost perspective from our healthcare.
If you take, go ahead.
After you.
I was going to say, if you take that example of Walmart giving suppliers of leafy green vegetables until September of 2019, and then they will be required to upload their information to a blockchain-like system. Well, that touches every agriculture, logistics. All the way to retail, and really, it's farm to table. So it's really going to touch a lot of different industries. And that's where, a lot of firms, they're being impacted first, not because it's, internal or the transactions are going onto a blockchain, but because the industries that they serve are coming in and saying, this technology is impacting me and we need help with it.
And what I was going to say is completely outside of finance. I was recently talking to one of my clients about this. It's a maritime client, international shipper. And I said, okay, I'm curious. Are you looking at blockchain? How are you thinking about it? What's the industry doing? And there's a lot of conversations out there. Maersk, which is a big liner company, has a joint venture with IBM. There's some other ones that are very publicly, they're very public out there. But the main conversation that he's having is, okay, when you have a container, it has a bill of lading, when does ownership transfer? And how do you have an event that triggers the ownership transfer? Do you put that on a permissioned or a permissionless system? And the industry has, more or less agreed that they need to go permissioned. But when everyone has a private blockchain, the issues that they're facing is, okay, well, how do all those blockchains communicate with each other? And how do you get that interoperability? So there's challenges, but it's a very fascinating area because it's the use of this technology that's completely outside of financial transactions.
And I love those technology challenges because we've seen it before. We've seen databases and we've seen different systems that we've created connectors, we've created APIs, we've created ways, we've created the technology to move that data and help that data flow. So interoperability, that's one of those technology challenges, but it's one that brilliant people are working on, and we'll get there. We'll definitely get there.
Yeah, I just would make one comment. you know, I sort of have a different perspective of what blockchain is. So to me, generally speaking, I see blockchain as business process improvement software, full stop. There's lots of different use cases for it, but at the end of the day, what ends up happening is we've had 30 years of business process improvement software sold by the SAPs of the world. They've made lots of business processes inside an enterprise, highly efficient, but at some point in time, you're not going to get a really good ROI implementing the next version of payables. Okay? So you're a CIO, and your job is to go out there and deploy firm capital and get X return. Well, you sort of look at it and you say, I'm kind of pretty efficient inside my finance function, but the business processes in between myself and my suppliers, or in some cases myself and my competitors, are absolutely awful and completely inefficient. And so then the question becomes, are what kind of technologies out there that if I deploy, I can get a 100x return on my investment? And so now you're a CIO and you basically stand there and you say, okay, I can get a 3% return from implementing SAP's next generation financials, or I can kind of roll the dice and I can get involved in this blockchain ecosystem thing with a couple of my competitors. But you know what? If it works, I'm going to get 100x return. And, you know, I generally see that although some of the use cases are crazy, broadly speaking, the efficiency gains are no longer going to be at the enterprise level. The efficiency gains are at the inter-enterprise or the ecosystem level. And so that's why I think, you know, if you're a betting person, you would go long on blockchain because you get the best ROI, and that's what CIOs are going to spend money on.
Yeah, I think that's right on. I mean, ultimately, blockchain is just it's a big, slow database, right? But it's immutable and can create, you know, that opportunity. I agree with you. From an ecosystem perspective, that's really where the value proposition is.
And, yep, Steve, you had a question?
Yeah, I'm going to actually waste your time and ask a couple. But it's not every day that auditing is really kind of front page hot news, but it is right now because of what's happening with Tether. So I was wondering if somebody, I think it would be beneficial to everyone to kind of just understand what Tether is, any possible explanations they have for not wanting to submit themselves to an audit other than the idea that they're not sufficiently capitalized, and why, what challenges are there with auditing a fiat-backed or even crypto-backed stablecoin? My second question, unrelated, is just, I'd be interested also in hearing your thoughts on international perspectives related to blockchain accounting and auditing, and what levels of synchronization are happening at the international level, because this is a global system, it's a distributed system, and if the U.S. is out there on an island, it's not going to do much good.
Okay, guys, who wants first dibs?
Well, I mean, CLA is not going to audit Tether, I'll tell you that. So, you know, I think it's interesting, though. You know, for me, and, you know, listen, I don't know if anybody listens to Laura Shin on her podcast, but they're fabulous. And she just had, I'm drawing a blank on their names, but the founders and talked through that evolution of bringing the new CEO in and all the different challenges that they had sort of at inception. I could be, you know, this is sort of my thought process as it relates to Tether in general, that really drives a lot of the conversation around governance and how does governance really play a role in a lot of this. So what I would say, we wouldn't audit Tether is because it just wouldn't fit our risk appetite. You know, we'd have to sort of understanding what's the real underlying value or business case. You know, it can't just be built up on a lot of people jumping in and throwing a bunch of money into something they think is going to work. There's got to be actual you know, validity behind the business itself. And I think there's a lot of, you know, cloudiness around Tether. But, you know, I don't know if you're, you know, you sort of asked auditing a stable coin. You know, I think stable coins are interesting. You know, I think it's a component of trying to just mark another cryptocurrency to, you know, a more fiat, you know, like a dollar. I don't know. It's almost like to me, like a crypto kitty. Like, I don't know, like, is there going to be value in these things long-term? Is it going to be, or is it really just a situation where we're trying to develop things to fit something that doesn't necessarily need to be fit? I don't know if you have a different perspective.
Yeah, I won't comment on Tether because I think, you know, whether or not they will or won't be audited, I think they've done a tremendous value to the ecosystem in terms of creating the concept of a stablecoin. So broadly speaking, I think that that's a heck of an innovation. In terms of the use of a stablecoin, it's important to understand that a majority of the transactions in the space from a crypto perspective happen over the counter. And right now, in order to execute an over-the-counter trade, you need cash and cash and crypto. Well, as soon as you start dealing with cash, you start dealing with banks. As soon as you start dealing with banks, well, then you got other problems in terms of other regulatory issues. So what's a way to get around that issue if you want to trade OTC is to create a stable coin, because then your transaction is crypto to crypto. And if, in fact, cryptos are utilities, then you're no longer in this whole issue of having securities. So there is a very distinct value to having stable coins. And the very first use case for that is to support and simplify OTC trading. Well, maybe not the first, but it's certainly one of the reasons why you saw Paxos came out with their stable coin, which is kicking butt in the marketplace from what I can tell. Gemini came out with one recently. And really, they just help facilitate very large transactions where the counterparties don't want to use cash because they don't want to have to deal with the issues associated with, you know, interacting with the banking system as defined and all the regulations associated with it.
I have just one comment, and I agree with you, Jeremy. You know, Tether has done amazing things for the ecosystem, and really proof of concept. I mean, I can get really excited and talk about, you know, the evolution of money, and, you know, we went from a barter system, and now, I pay everything with this. I we live in a world where it costs more money to make money than the money is worth. So could the next evolution of what we think of as money be a stable coin?
And do you have any comments on this, Brett, or
I do not have any comments to this topic.
So I want to shift our conversation slightly, right? So just want to link it into some of the other topics that have been brought up, because there were several comments made that really the whole conversation on blockchain itself has almost moved, right? Because it all started with Bitcoin basically bursting out onto the scene. All of that sort of got most people who were interested in blockchain became interested in blockchain through Bitcoin, right? But now it's almost becoming more of a ecosystem conversation or a supply chain conversation. And so a question that I have and that I want to pose to the panel is that changing sort of how blockchain is going to be used? Because, and I do forget who said it, I'm not sure if it was Brett or Amanda, but if all of these firms like Walmart, like IBM, like Toyota, like British Airways, if all of them have their own private blockchains, are we actually moving away from the core idea of a blockchain towards more of a traditional sort of centralized hub?
Yeah, the answer is yes.
Yeah. What does that mean for us?
Well,
then?
I think it just goes back to, you know, you have to know, you know, what you're working with, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if the question is, and I think, I forgot the guy's name, I just asked that question. Steve was sort of asking the global impact versus US being on board. You know, I think there's so many different components within this conversation, but at the original essence of Bitcoin, obviously it was focused on getting away from fiat currency and taking cash out of government's hands so that mm-hmm. we can all have our own possession and custody of our cash. And I think that resonates much more strongly outside the U.S. than it does within the U.S. I mean, obviously, it all came out right after the financial markets were crashing. That's not an accident. We all know that. But if you look at Argentina, for example, or other countries where they've just dealt with crazy amounts of inflation, you know, there's just a lot of mistrust. And I think ultimately, if you ask the question what the core of Bitcoin was or is, that's what it was. And what's happened is corporations and others have started to see and start to dig in what is this Bitcoin, and then, you know, sometime late last or middle of 2017 started to understand that there's an underlying technology there And now they're basically trying to morph that technology into, you know, how do we use this to create efficiencies, or really maybe different ways of creating immutability across, and whether it's the supply chain or whatever the case may be. So I believe there's a huge rift there. And if you get back to the ecosystem conversation, you know, you're talking about an ecosystem of a whole bunch of developers who really kind of believe in the original concept, right? And this is really what we want to do. And they want to drive transparency. My opinion is that that's going to come to a head at some point. You know, I think, I don't know what that's going to look like. But, you know, if all of a sudden the Walmarts of the world are going in, it's just like, you know, back in the day with the dot-com boom where Microsoft was the bad guy and all these small little developer companies were trying to do their thing. That's kind of where we are now. In the age of, instead of the age of the internet, it's really the age of, you know, digital asset transfer. You know, it's an interesting concept. I don't know what it means for us, so mm-hmm. I'm going to let the rest of the panel handle that part of it. But I think there is definitely, you know, sort of this permissioned versus permissionless. And the permissionless, I believe at some point is going to take more hold, is going to have a stronger effect, because I think that's where the community is focused on. And at some point or other, they're going to really drive that across the rest of the ecosystem.
Yeah, you mentioned and draw parallels to the internet, and we hear that a lot because there are a lot of parallels. But, you know, in the 90s, the internet was about sharing information and email, and people started asking the question, can we use this for business? And that's the same question that we're asking now about blockchain. Can this be used to do business and to improve business process? And the answer is yes. That's all part of the evolution of it. And as we've discussed, the ecosystems that are really being developed. And again, to your dot-com point, some of them will make it and some of them will not. So it'll be interesting to see how the landscape looks in, I'd say, 5 years, not even 5 years, 2 years, this stuff is moving so quickly.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, I did a lot of work in enterprise blockchain before I sort of moved over to crypto for the purposes of working at Libra. But the rubber hits the road in terms of who owns the data and the IP rights. So you get like 10 different companies together, and it makes all the sense in the world for them to put together some sort of a blockchain to make a process more efficient. Where these problems, where those use cases fall down is who owns the IP and, you know, who's got data rights. And really that's, you know, when people ask, like, why is it taking so long for the technology to proliferate? First of all, I think it's happening incredibly quickly, so I don't generally agree with that statement. But broadly speaking, if you do go down that path of thinking, it really comes down to just data rights and IP. You know, the biggest companies want to own all the IP associated with the transactions on those networks because that's where the value is. And I think we need some more IP and data governance models to be able to drive the proliferation of the technology from an enterprise standpoint. And I think we're going to get there. I mean, it's in everybody's best interest. We're not as efficient as we can be. You know, the world wants to see 7% growth in our, you know, in our 401ks. You're not going to get there investing assets in, from your company generating 1% growth, you know, in ERP. You know, you need these innovations to take effect, and I think they will.
The only thing I'd like to add to that is more just kind of a broad remark. From attending events and speaking to people in the industry, they describe cryptocurrency and blockchain, they describe it as a movement. If this is Web 3.0, this is the democratization of assets. It's almost cultish how some people describe this, which I find very interesting, and it's fascinating. But at the same time, there's a reason that all of us are in the room together tonight talking about, okay, how do we, you know, how do we bring the trusted intermediaries in and make them trusted again? How do we, you know, how do we do what cryptocurrency is intended to do? And sometimes that's almost fitting a square peg in a round hole. And so, you know, in one aspect, maybe we are straying away from Satoshi's vision, but maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And what I want to build on, right, is the issue of actually governance, right, building out those those IP practices, who owns information stored on the blockchain. If it's on a public blockchain, who owns it, right? And then what body or bodies based where? Here in the US or overseas? And how does that process actually work? Because I do think that all of us know that all those conversations are currently happening and do have to happen. But I'd be interested in the panel's thoughts on so what are the core drivers of those conversations, and then how is that going to impact information already stored on those blockchains, and then sort of which part of the blockchain ecosystem, whether it's public, whether it's private, or some hybrid version of that, actually takes the lead going forward.
Well, I'll say, you know, a lot of the technologies that are being built, they're being built on open source mm-hmm. technology. Mm-hmm. So there are questions around how do you license that?
It's a serious question too.
Yeah. And again, we went through it in the 90s mm-hmm. with you know, the internet and Linux and open source then. So again, I think we'll figure it out, but I do think that's something that we're not paying enough attention to, and some of the developers of these tools out there are not paying enough attention to. So.
Yeah, I just would say that governance is a global phenomenon, and a lot of the laws are localized. So if you're starting to deal with an enterprise blockchain program that has users in multiple different jurisdictions, you're immediately starting from behind the eight ball. You've got some people that will look at it under Swiss law, some people that are looking under US law, and you know, who's right, who's wrong, there's probably no good answer, but essentially there's no unifying governance model, and every jurisdiction is fighting for, you know, jobs and substance, and so it's just messy. Don't necessarily know if there's a good answer. What I would say, though, is that a majority of the architects of these systems are the IBMs of the world, and generally they're not lawyers, right? They're IT people, and so you know, all of a sudden, you know, you have, you know, you don't have an integrated solution from that perspective. So I think, again, that's sort of another one of those structural issues that slows down the adoption of the tech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like any tech, it's going to take some time, but I mean, it's doing really well. I would sort of just throw a quick shout out. You know, the model that I like best is the public permissioned types of infrastructure, where anybody can join, but there's a group of private or permissioned nodes that have to validate the transactions. There's a really great one called the Agreements Network, which is going to be released in Q4. That's focused on automating legal agreements and making what you would think of as standard legal agreements, you know, a product instead of a service. And anybody in the world can upload an agreement to this network, but there's going to be permissioned nodes that have to validate that agreement actually would stand up in the court of law. So I like these public permissioned networks. I like them all. I mean, of course, I like them all, but I certainly like this very specific model because it allows anyone to participate, but it applies a quality control mechanism on top of the network to ensure that there's a level of substance to, you know, the information that's actually being uploaded.
Mm-hmm. And then, Brett, did you have any sort of tips you would advise? So if somebody was to ask you, right, keeping it purely just in a theory, right? What would your top two or three things be for a firm or a coalition of institutions that are trying to build out some of these governance networks and, you know, some frameworks?
So what I would tell a prospective new client who is getting into the business and launching a new venture, it's bring in the advisors early, bring in the accountants, the auditors, your lawyers, mm-hmm. You know, your strategic advisors, bring them in early so everyone's on the same page about what you're doing. As far as, you know, our role in that, it's, you know, we want to communicate, we want to be on the same page, we want to understand if you're doing a token offering, what are the rights associated with that token? What is your company going to do? Do you have a viable business model? Do you have all the proper agreements in place? To your point about who owns the data, that's a question that's easy to answer if it's answered up front. We can contract around that with agreements. So it's bringing people in early, having those conversations early so everyone is in communication and on the same page about a lot of these issues. It prevents them from really blowing up later.
And I'd say that having those types of conversations up front is even more important, as more types of information from a whole bunch of different types of institutions, both in the healthcare, in the food safety, shipping, as all of that data, on top of all of the financial data already being uploaded onto blockchains, keeps happening, outlining those terms and the conditions, who owns the data, and then who has the rights to actually take actions on the blockchain is going to become more important. So I do also know that this whole topic of crypto and blockchain has been getting more and more focus down in Washington. There have been quite a few hearings and some roundtables. There was actually one that happened last week that was quite fiery that happened last week, but there have been ongoing conversations down there. And so really sort of what I'm interested in just personally and for our conversation here is, you know, are there any trends or stories or topics or concepts that have come across your desks or in conversations with your clients that have to do with this increased interest? And it does seem to be all of a sudden a increased interest in this area. And then if yes, what are some of those implications that you're thinking about now as this becomes more and more of a, you know, hot topic almost?
I would say that it's more than interest, that's for sure.
I was putting it mildly.
You know, we spent multiple hours with a bunch of the three-letter firms, and, you know, they're incredibly smart. So and if anybody thinks, you know, I would say that up until like 6 to 12 months ago, if somebody asked me the question, I'd be like, ah, the regulator's behind the ball. Not even close. You know, we were in California, we met with one, and we had like a 2.5-hour meeting, and I walked out and I said, they knew the answer to every single question that they asked us except for one. Like, that's an incredibly impressive feat. I mean, we're a software company in it every day, and they're a regulator, and they knew it all. So I would just broadly say that, you know, the idea that it's of interest, I mean, these people are, their livelihood depends on making sure that they put out the right regulatory frameworks. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but, you know, about 6 to 12 months ago, I mean, these people just got religion. So, I guess I'll stop there.
That's refreshing because, I live in D.C., so I'm kind of numb to all things in, you know, in D.C. But it is refreshing because I do think some of the different regulators are they're being held back because everyone's waiting on someone else. But someone's going to have to really step up and be first. But I do think that they are, to your point, they are more informed. Some of them are definitely more informed. And that's part of what we need to do, is to continue to inform not only the public, but help them as well. It's part of our responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed the same thing with my clients. Everyone wants to know which way the wind is going to blow and when. From a tax perspective, all I was told was that the IRS is going to put out guidance. They said by the end of the year, but I have a feeling it'll be sometime early 2019. What that guidance will look like is anyone's guess.
I guess, not to steal your thunder because I'm
I mean,
look, part of the issue here in terms of regulation is, let's just assume for a minute that you're the IRS and your job is to make sure that everybody's paying tax. And it turns out that you're like, guess what? These are securities. So, you know, everybody that's out there is trading them. Get ready to get a 1099-B with cost basis. Okay, that sounds great, except for no one knows what their cost basis is on any asset. There's no infrastructure to provide that data to anybody. So part of the issue that the regulators have is, number one is they want to apply a certain rule set because that's what they need to do in terms of creating a regulatory framework. But the other issue is that the structure of the ecosystem is completely opposite of the ability for any taxpayer to actually get that data to be able to do it. There are things that are happening in the ecosystem that I think will deal with the issues of cost basis as it relates to digital assets specifically. But broadly speaking, I think the regulators are trying to balance the need to apply a framework with the reality that a lot of the technology in order to actually implement that framework just doesn't even exist. And it's that so do they actually create a framework and then force the industry to do it? What we've seen more than often is not is the regulators are basically coming to us or to the industry saying, self-regulate. You know what the rules are. Figure it out. You've got a certain amount of time. You either figure it out or we're going to actually figure it out for you, and you most likely won't like our answer. So we're still in, the part where the industry has the opportunity to self-regulate and come up with rules based on what technology is available. And it's our job to actually get the job done. And if we don't, and the regulators come in and they put in a whole bunch of rules that we hate, you know, and we'll look back in retrospect and figure out that we lost a good opportunity. I think like anything in this space, it's everybody. I mean, it's an ecosystem play, right? So it's service providers, it's the people that actually are going to trade the assets, if we're talking digital assets. I mean, it's a combination of everybody. It isn't just one person, and that's part of the problem is we all have to have a conversation that we, you know, heretofore have never had to do before. Well, I mean, certainly they're part of it, you know. Exchanges are part of it. The banks are part of it. Like I said, anytime I get to ask that question, I'm just like, it's all of us. Certainly exchanges have a part to play, but you know, exchanges have their own issues, right? They're centralized infrastructure, and what's the new apex predator potentially coming on the block are decentralized exchanges, which completely blow up that business model. So, you know, you put the onus on a centralized exchange to come up with a regulatory regime. Meanwhile, the biggest competitor in the room may end up turn out to be decentralized exchanges. And I don't know if that's the case. So it's just we have an opportunity right now to do it. And if we don't do it and the regulators come down and offer a framework that is really onerous for us to actually execute, I'm just going to look back and shake my head and feel like we lost a really good opportunity.
But the we have a responsibility to work with those regulators. The AICPA submitted, you know, recommended FAQs to the IRS. Hopefully that guidance that they're working on mm-hmm. will incorporate those things because yeah. that's the we that got together and came up with those. So we hope that the regulators will listen to us.
Okay, so to wrap up sort of the panel part of our panel, and then I'll open it up for any questions or some comments out there from the audience, is I have a hopefully quick part A and a part B question for all four of you. So a common comment from some people out there who aren't as adamantly pro blockchain as all of us are here is that blockchain is perhaps overhyped, or that the cart has gotten in front of the horse and all of us are out here talking about all of these applications and benefits, but the actuality is quite different. So I'd be interested sort of on your thoughts on that. And then the part B, which is hopefully easier, is if we had this panel again in 12 months, What is the one biggest thing that you would hope to see change in this ecosystem? I put you guys on the spot here with this last one. So, Brett, do you want to start or do you want to?
I think I can take a stab at part
okay.
A.
At part A, great.
Part A, my response would be, can you afford not to jump into this space? And if this takes off, you'll be left in the dust. Look at Sears. There, the headline this week was, Sears could have been Amazon. Well, we know how that story ends. you know, this is a similar, you're at a similar crossroads right now. For part B, what will happen in the next year? Maybe.
What's the one thing you would hope
we'll have
to see?
Come back and see, right?
Yeah. We'll do this again in 12 months. Probably guidance. I'd like to see, more firms, especially more established firms, get into the space. I think they'll do that once guidance is put out there and there's a little more comfort in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part A, what would I say to folks who think that this whole blockchain thing is overhyped? I would say that I would tell them that actually they're right in some cases. I mean, Gartner has their hype cycle, and we're coming down out of that. So there have been a lot of elevated expectations, but same thing in the 90s, the dot-com boom. I mean, we're gonna see it. It probably is overhyped, but that doesn't mean that it's not relevant. And to your point, mm-hmm. I mean, if they don't get into it now, they're gonna be the serious. I mean, I'm sitting here today because I didn't actually invest in Bitcoin early. I would be one of those. I think you said they've got I'd be cruising my Lambo right now. But I think in 12 months, what I would like to see, and I think what we will see, is one of the most exciting applications, I think, of blockchain, which is identity, self-sovereign identity, identity in general. That is something that is developing that I'm very, very excited about. So I think that from technology and accounting, it can have some interesting applications.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we'll be talking about that when we get back together next year.
Great, hopefully.
Yeah, I feel a little bit at times lately that I'm somewhat living like a schizophrenic life where half the time I'm piped into the community and everybody knows what we're talking about and there's just so much, momentum and excitement and evolution of this technology, for lack of a better word. But then the other half of my life, I talk to everybody else that I work with, and they're just way behind. And it's kind of cool. It's an exciting perspective, but at the end of the day, I believe that for the most part, we're sort of moving beyond the early adopter phase, and I think people are starting to understand that this is something that actually has legs, and we're going to have to start paying attention to it. And I think you see that within the regulatory bodies. I think they've spent the last however many, 6 to 12 months, whatever the case may be, just really trying to dig in, research, and understand what's happening. And now are starting to figure out that, they have to figure something out. And I think, the rest of the country is going to catch on to that, at least within the U.S. perspective. 12 months from now, again, I'm a healthcare guy, so I would love to see some healthcare solutions around this technology. If I think about, maybe a pie in the sky thought that I would love to see happen really quickly is within healthcare, it's all about trying to move from volume to value and deal with outcomes. And with outcomes comes, the need for data and understanding how those outcomes are derived. I could imagine, a whole set of health systems and healthcare providers within a distributed ledger that are all putting outcome information that's really public information, but each individual patient has a private key that keeps their information safe, and we're all HIPAA compliant, all that fun stuff. But all of a sudden, we have this amazing transaction set or database of outcomes that all the different providers can tap into and make really meaningful progress around how we care and how we deliver care. That would be my, I would be really ecstatic about that.
Cool. I'll answer the second question first. What we'll see is the State Streets, Bank of New York, Mellon's, Morgan Stanley's, Northern Trusts of the world actually have custody solutions and provide the capability for existing hedge funds to trade crypto. So there are 500 crypto funds today with like $5 billion in assets. And there are something like 12,000 hedge funds with like $3 trillion in assets. As soon as the top five fund administrators in the world allow existing hedge funds to trade crypto, that's the bottom of the first inning, in my opinion. you have hedge funds. You have one hedge fund at State Street that has more market value than the entire crypto ecosystem combined. I mean, as soon as those hedge funds are able to buy and sell crypto, good night, nurse. So I think what we'll see in 12 months is that will be the case, that all of the biggest fund administrators will have both a custody and a fund administration solution. Existing hedge funds will come in. They will institutionalize the space, and the amount of money that's available for those assets is going to just go banana pancakes. In terms of you know, the first question that you asked, you know, like on every dimension that I look at data, like it's already, our world is so different already just 7 years after Bitcoin. I mean, like just the amount of intellectual horsepower, the amount of value that's been traded, the amount of infrastructure that's built. Like if anybody says to me like it's overhyped, I'm like, you're not looking at the things that you should be looking at. And I guess, you know, I get that point of view. Like the most interesting books for me to read are like people in war that write their memoirs, or like in their financial crash, people that were writing a book during the financial crash. Like you have no context, right, when you're in the middle of it. And, you know, I just think that the world is changing at a tremendous rate, and we've already been so successful with this tech that for people that tell me it's like overhyped, I'm like, man, you're not in a part of the ecosystem to be able to see just how different the world is.
Awesome responses. And then now I was going to open it up for any questions or comments from the audience. And I think we have a question up here.
Talk quite a bit about blockchain as it relates to different industries and so forth. Do you see any application to the accounting business?
Yeah, I mean, this is a softball, so I'm going to just let you guys go for this. But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, look, once you change a meta process, like a supply chain process, all of the sub processes get re-engineered. So how you actually audit that business process is going to change because the meta business process has changed. And so, you know, at the end of the day, you know, for me, you know, as I, you know, what got me stoked about the technology when I was at PwC is there were all of these huge, you know, the possibilities of redefining identity, of redefining supply chains, of redefining the, you know, pharma business processes. But as soon as you look down one layer, all those sub-business processes get re-engineered, and accounting is in every single one of them. So, you know, I just think fundamentally, you know, as the world re-engineers all of these major or meta business processes, accounting just has to change because, you know, the main business process changes, the sub-business processes get re-engineered.
We have an accountant on the panel.
Yeah.
Would you like
to take a couple of accounts on the panel?
Yeah. I mean, that was really well said, so it's kind of hard to follow that up. But, you know, I, how could we not change, I guess, is the response to that, right? I mean, we spend a lot of time at our firm trying to look at how this is going to impact our clients. We spend some time looking at how is it going to impact us as far as, you know, do we need to change our processes and our structure? How can we benefit from this technology? It's a little bit more gray at this point. So we're really focused on, you know, just being prepared to be able to provide guidance to our clients. I mean, that's what we're all about. But, you know, at the end of the day, if we have technology that can be built where you don't have to go fishing for every transaction, but you know that you have a set of transactions that are well done and we can audit that really efficiently and quickly, it allows us to have more time to add better value from a guidance and, you know, analysis perspective. So, we're already looking at our staff, our workforce, and saying, you know, what are the gaps that we need to focus on? I know, I'm sure you saw it, Jeremy, when you were, I don't know how long ago it was, but I'm sure they were hiring data analytics. And, you know, I do recruiting still myself. I enjoy going out to colleges and campuses and interacting with the poor young kids that are dying to get a job, you know, and all of them are like, oh, I'm an accountant with a, you know, a data scientist minor or something like that, or data engineering. I talk with, we have a young guy who joined us in our state and local tax practice, and he's out, you know, training himself on how to write in Python and all these different things. And So, you know, that's going to have a tremendous impact on what we do and how we deliver value to our clients. But yeah, I can't tell you exactly what it's going to look like.
Yeah, I've had some fun conversations lately talking about smart contracts and walking through the Walmart example and having those conversations of what does it do to, you know, sales and use tax? How would you incorporate, you know, value add tax? These are things, and to your point earlier about getting the right people in the conversation from the beginning, I hope that you know, the folks who are developing these smart contracts are considering these things. Because it is, to your point, Jeremy, it is going to trickle down and change every process under it.
Yes, Ron.
So not too long ago, I'm sure the panelists are aware that the SEC commented, specific commissioner commented on the idea of appropriately decentralized when they said Ether is not a security. And so not too long ago, we had the opportunity to chat with former CFTC Commissioner Gensler, who talked about the idea that ecosystems need to be defined as securities or not securities, whether or not they're appropriately decentralized. So for example, if the programmers of a particular ecosystem walked away, would that ecosystem survive? And that was kind of a high-level conversation.
Right.
And in this conversation, I said, well, who defines and who should audit appropriately decentralized? And so for the panel, I would ask, in your opinion, is the accounting profession, the industry and profession that should define ecosystems as appropriately decentralized, and why?
That's a fun one.
And you're welcome.
Yeah. I think it goes back to, you know, defining what, you know, what the role of an auditor is in, you know, in the coming years. And I do think that the accounting profession is a profession that's built on trust, and our clients trust us because typically CPAs don't trust anyone. You know, they check the debits and the credits, and we have an opportunity to build on that trust and provide provide some of these new services and to evolve the services that we provide. So I do think that the accounting profession, our profession, even if you can take the accounting word out of it, and I think our profession is the one that can provide that, you know, that level of trust for our clients.
And I would say the accounting profession certainly has to have a role in it, but certainly, other regulatory bodies and, legal needs to have some role. You know, I think about, I'm always very clear on how far I'm willing to go when I'm doing any type of work and when all of a sudden I need to go out and reach out to an attorney. I'm really clear with that because I've got a group of individuals to make sure that I'm really clear that I'm not moving past sort of my role and my piece of it. You start talking about, who's making a decision on what a decentralized blockchain system, really either the governance or ownership of that. I mean, for me, that automatically, requires other individuals to come into that. So the profession should certainly have a say and have a big part in, how do you account for that? But I don't know that we'd really want to be the only individuals making that decision ultimately.
Yeah, so that comment was made in a speech that had no structure behind it and has since had no definition to actually be able to define it. So broadly speaking, if any accountant decided to account that, I would think they were crazy. But, broadly speaking, I think
that up.
Yeah, attorneys may love that. But broadly speaking, like, this is an awesome opportunity for like the AICPA and all these other organizations. Like, okay, we have to come up with an ecosystem auditing standard. What the heck is that? What does it look like? You know, what's the framework for it? How do we define it? You know, the regulators made a comment that said it was appropriately decentralized, but there's no definition underneath it because it's a concept that didn't exist up until that moment in time. So now who are the smart people in the room that actually have the ability to create a framework that can actually be measured and accounted over time? It would be, in this case, the folks like the AICPA and others. So I would say that that's a cool opportunity. right? So there's an absence of definition. There are people that are smart that know how to actually create structure from that kind of chaos. And, you know, if I was, you know, a young accountant, that would be like a cool thing that I would love to work on.
The only other thing I would add to that is that Director Hinman's remarks, certainly not law or regulation, shouldn't be relied upon other than kind of as, you know, other than what they are. And that's all the more reason why it's, you know, that we, that self-regulating we, that's why it's all that more important.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Any jokes? No, I'm kidding. No. Okay, then I guess, yes.
So, what advice would you give Malta, which is self-regulating the crowded team, to get a little
story on the blockchain? Jerry, is it going out and build their own? Is it, what would you tell them?
Number one, change your hiring practices. You're probably hiring the wrong people. That's probably number one. Put in place number two, a retraining program for the people that you've already hired. So those would be the very first two things I would do. Once I've done that is I would really probably cut the world on two ways. I would either say I'm very focused on enterprise blockchain sorts of use cases because the accounting, tax, and audit implications are quite a bit different than those accounting, audit, and tax implications as when you start dealing with crypto assets, or digital assets, right? There is a world, they do in fact intersect. But, you know, broadly speaking, you can build practices from where I sit specifically around enterprise blockchain use cases, and you can build them specifically around digital asset use cases. And so I would take a step back and I would look at my firm and I would look at my competitive position and I would say, I'm better equipped to, you know, do enterprise blockchain, or I'm better equipped to do crypto and digital assets. And then from there, I would start talking to smart people. Like, again, this is the we. You know, I would start looking at, you know, software firms. I'd start to talk to, everybody in the ecosystem, interestingly, from where I sit, is incredibly open. And so, and Amanda made this point, right? Like, everybody's willing to talk. Like, you can actually pick up the phone and you can call the CEO of a lot of crypto firms and they actually answer the phone and they'll talk your ear off for an hour. So it would be, and I'm not a consultant in terms of helping accounting firms grow, but certainly a very organized approach to get networked into the right people that actually can, you know, get you the first starter projects. But broadly speaking, it's retraining, look at who you're hiring, enterprise blockchain versus digital assets, and then get connected. That would be my approach.
Mic drop.
If that's it, let's say thank you to our panel and to our moderator.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you to Sean for an excellent job moderating and keeping us on track, and Brett, Amanda, James, and Jeremy for their insights. We've got more hors d'oeuvres, I believe, if they're still out there, and I think some more wine as well. So enjoy yourselves. Thank you, everyone, and thank you to our panel.